Listening test, task 1. You are going to listen to an interview with the author Alex Perry and risk analyst Manji Cheto. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 8 with the sentence endings A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Africa is booming. Not that you'd know it from the way we present it in the West. And yet we get Africa wrong. We have always got Africa wrong. That is part of the message in a new book by Alex Perry, who used to be an Africa bureau chief for Time magazine. His book is called The Rift, A New Africa Breaks Free. He's here in the studio with me now, and we're joined on the line by Manji Cheto, who's a risk consultant with Teneo Intelligence, which has advised various African governments over the years. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Alex Perry, we get Africa wrong. Why? Because we paint this dismal picture that portrays the whole of Africa as a basket case.
Essentially, yes. A really good example is the migrant crisis right now. The Africans who are turning up, crossing the Mediterranean and so on, are given this term economic migrants. And the idea is that they're coming from a place of destitution and trying to sort of better themselves. Consider what they're paying to get here. It's $5,000 to $10,000 a head. The amazing thing about that is not the inequality of the fact that it costs me $500 to go to Africa, but the fact that so many people can afford it. They're not coming because they're poor. They're coming because increasingly they're not. You know, the change there. The book is about, you know, trying to change the perceptions of Africa, which we have got wrong almost since the first European went to Africa. It's, you know, we saw savages in the Victorian era. We saw actually a lesser form of man, and there's a residual prejudice there, even in the aid campaigns that dominate essentially the coverage of Africa, which portray Africa as a starving baby.
Manji Cheto, I mean, this must be something that you become frustrated with when you see that sort of portrayal from other countries.
No, absolutely. And I think Alex touched on a very important point, right, is that when we talk about sort of history around the world, Africa's history is often ignored. And when that history is told, it's told from the perspective of effectively colonizers. So I think, you know, that's where the misconception starts, and kind of bringing it to modern times, unfortunately. And I think, you know, the intention is certainly well-meaning from development agencies, but the way that campaigns are, you know, the images that people get bombarded with on a daily basis in the West is about, you know, starving African children. Rarely do we tell the story of Africans who are making great discoveries and groundbreaking discoveries around the world. And I think that's really where the sort of rebalancing needs to happen. There are two faces of Africa, but people only see one.
And Alex Perry, you make the point that there are some of Africa's 54 countries are doing incredibly well. I mean, better, growing faster than any other country in the world.
Well, that's right. Since about 2003, Africa has doubled global economic growth, and in pick any year, at least 5 out of 10 of the fastest growing countries of the world are African. They beat India, they beat China. I mean, there's actually no greater recognition of how well Africa doing than there are now 1 million Chinese who have emigrated to Africa. You know, 1 million people from the hottest economy of the last 30 years have moved to Africa. What does that tell you? I mean, it is really the land of opportunity. It Of course it has challenges and problems.
Well, let's move on to those, because you do identify what you think are the particular challenges that it needs to confront, which are?
Well, essentially, what links these three things are this is a struggle for sovereignty and freedom. So the challenges are Africans pushing back against those who would treat it in a very old-fashioned paternalistic way. So those would be
the dictators,
their own dictators, the new emergent jihadi groups, and aid workers.
Africa is booming. Not that you'd know it from the way we present it in the West. And yet we get Africa wrong. We have always got Africa wrong. That is part of the message in a new book by Alex Perry. He used to be an Africa bureau chief for Time magazine. His book is called The Rift, A New Africa Breaks Free. He's here in the studio with me now, and we're joined on the line by Manji Chetto, who's a risk consultant with Teneo Intelligence, which has advised various African governments over the years. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Alex Perry, we get Africa wrong. Why? Because we paint this dismal picture that portrays the whole of Africa as a basket case.
Essentially, yes. A really good example is the migrant crisis right now. The Africans who are turning up, crossing the Mediterranean and so on, are given this term economic migrants, and the idea is that they're coming from a place of destitution and trying to sort of better themselves. Consider what they're paying to get here. It's $5,000 to $10,000 a head. The amazing thing about that is not the inequality of the fact that it costs me $500 to go to Africa, but the fact that so many people can afford it. They're not coming because they're poor. They're coming because increasingly they're not. You know, the change there. The book is about, you know, trying to change the perceptions of Africa, which we have got wrong almost since the first European went to Africa. It's, you know, we saw savages in the Victorian era. We saw actually a lesser form of man, and there's a residual prejudice there, even in the aid campaigns that dominates essentially the coverage of Africa, which portray Africa as a starving baby.
Manji Chetto, I mean, this must be something that you become frustrated with when you see that sort of portrayal from other countries.
No, absolutely. And I think Alex touched on a very important point, right, is that when we talk about sort of history around the world, Africa's history is often ignored. And when that history is told, it's told from the perspective of effectively colonizers. So I think, you know, that's where the misconception starts, and kind of bringing it to modern times, unfortunately. And I think, you know, the intention is certainly well-meaning from development agencies, but the way that campaigns you know, the images that people get bombarded with on a daily basis in the West is about, you know, starving African children. Rarely do we tell the story of Africans who are making great discoveries and groundbreaking discoveries around the world. And I think that's really where the sort of rebalancing needs to happen. There are two faces of Africa, but people only see one.
And Alex Perry, you make the point that there are some of Africa's 54 countries are doing incredibly well. I mean, better, growing faster than any other country in the world.
Well, that's right. Since about 2003, Africa has doubled global economic growth, and in pick any year, at least 5 out of 10 of the fastest growing countries of the world are African. They beat India, they beat China. I mean, there's actually no greater recognition of how well Africa doing than there are now 1 million Chinese who have emigrated to Africa. You know, 1 million people from the hottest economy of the last 30 years have moved to Africa. What does that tell you? I mean, it is really the land of opportunity. Of course it has challenges and problems.
Let's move on to those, because you do identify what you think are the particular challenges that it needs to confront, which are?
Well, essentially, what links these three things are this is a struggle for sovereignty and freedom. So the challenges are Africans pushing back against those who would treat it in a very old-fashioned paternalistic way. So those would be
the dictators,
their own dictators, the new emergent jihadi groups, and aid workers.
Task 2. You are going to listen to an interview with Jeff Bernstein on the role of robots in the workplace. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 9 with the sentence endings A to L. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
What are we seeing in terms of robotics growth? And I'm just wondering, can we even focus it on Michigan? Are you able to give us a sense of how much it's grown?
Not specifically on Michigan, although you can infer. The industry is growing at double digits each year and is expected to for the next several years. Record sales each year. The biggest user is the automotive industry. So GM, Ford, Chrysler, all investing heavily in robotics, and likely that makes this area in Michigan one of the leading places to find robotics.
The auto industry was really kind of the groundbreakers for so much of use of robotics.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what other industries are we seeing it get inroads?
Oh, consumer goods, warehousing and distribution, electronics, food. Almost every industry is looking at robotics right now.
And what kind of tasks can robots do?
Well, usually the dull, dangerous, and dirty jobs, like welding and painting in an automotive factory. But we're increasingly seeing robots doing work side by side with humans in warehouses, packaging food. There's a lot of things that robots are doing today that they couldn't have done years ago.
Jeff, there's this common perception that I'm sure you encounter all the time that an increase in robotics equals lost jobs. How accurate is that?
Well, I can tell you, we encounter this every day. We took a 20-year look at this from 1996 to 2015. And the results were counterintuitive, let's say. In every period where robot sales were rising, unemployment was falling. And in every period where robot sales were falling, unemployment was rising. Now, why is that? We believe it's because the real threat to jobs is the inability to compete. And when companies invest in robotics, they give their company a better chance to compete and therefore save and create new jobs. And we have all kinds of anecdotal stories about this.
Give us a Michigan story.
A Michigan story. A company called Vickers Engineering on the west side of the state. They were having a difficulty keeping people in these entry-level, dull, dangerous, and dirty jobs. So they would hire them, they would train them, and then the people would leave, and then they would retrain new people. And it was a real drag on their ability to compete. So they decided, let's invest in automation. They did, and as a result, they were able to bring their costs down. They eliminated this turnover that was going on and were able to successfully win new business that they couldn't have won before. In their case, I think it was from Toyota. As a result, since they've automated, they've won new business and added more people than they had before they started. This is not unusual.
The people that were doing those dull, dangerous, dirty jobs, do they have the skills to move up to better jobs?
They could, because a lot of the jobs require skills that you can get at community colleges and technical schools. These are not all four-year degree engineering jobs. These are machine operators, people who have hands-on ability to install the technology. These are a lot of where the growth is going to be in the jobs.
And the kind of jobs that are more interesting and will keep people there longer.
Yeah, we think. I mean, today's manufacturing facilities are nothing like people remember from years past. They're not dirty places. They're very clean. They're high tech. They're great environments to work in, and there are tremendous jobs there.
When you look at the research on jobs and automation, there are such widely divergent findings. One that I dug up in 2013, a couple of researchers from Oxford found that robotics would be putting 48% of the jobs in the United States in danger. And then last year, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development figured, well, across 21 countries, 9% of jobs would be automated. Why is there such a major difference?
Well, in the case of that Oxford study, I actually debated them. They're looking at tasks and they're saying, here's what the technology can do that people are doing. Therefore, that equals the jobs are going to disappear. That's not at all the case. And some of the other studies have looked at, well, jobs are going to disappear at a slower pace. But the reality is, ask some of these companies how many jobs they would have if they hadn't automated. And the answer is often zero. The reason, because they would have had to send these jobs overseas to China or Mexico or somewhere else, but automation will allow them to compete.
What are we seeing in terms of robotics growth? And I'm just wondering, can we even focus it on Michigan? Are you able to give us a sense of how much it's grown?
Not specifically on Michigan, although you can infer. The industry is growing at double digits each year and is expected to for the next several years, record sales each year. The biggest user is the automotive industry. So GM, Ford, Chrysler, all investing heavily in robotics, and likely that makes this area in Michigan one of the leading places to find robotics.
The auto industry was really kind of the groundbreakers for so much of use of robotics.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what other industries are we seeing it get inroads?
Oh, consumer goods, warehousing and distribution, electronics, food. Almost every industry is looking at robotics right now.
And what kind of tasks can robots do?
Well, usually the dull, dangerous, and dirty jobs, like welding and painting in an automotive factory. But we're increasingly seeing robots doing work side by side with humans in warehouses, packaging food. There's a lot of things that robots are doing today that they couldn't have done years ago.
Jeff, there's this common perception that I'm sure you encounter all the time that an increase in robotics equals lost jobs. How accurate is that?
Well, I can tell you, we encounter this every day. We took a 20-year look at this from 1996 to 2015, and the results were counterintuitive, let's say. In every period where robot sales were rising, unemployment was falling. And in every period where robot sales were falling, unemployment was rising. Now, why is that? We believe it's because the real threat to jobs is the inability to compete. And when companies invest in robotics, they give their company a better chance to compete and therefore save and create new jobs. And we have all kinds of anecdotal stories about this.
Give us a Michigan story.
A Michigan story, a company called Vickers Engineering on the west side of the state. They were having a difficulty keeping people in these entry-level, dull, dangerous, and dirty jobs. So they would hire them, they would train them, and then the people would leave, and then they would retrain new people. And it was a real drag on their ability to compete. So they decided, let's invest in automation. They did, and as a result, they were able to bring their costs down. They eliminated this turnover that was going on and were able to successfully win new business that they couldn't have won before. In their case, I think it was from Toyota. As a result, since they've automated, they've won new business and added more people than they had before they started. This is not unusual.
The people that were doing those dull, dangerous, dirty jobs, do they have the skills to move up to better jobs?
They could, because a lot of the jobs require skills that you can get at community colleges and technical schools. These are not all four-year degree engineering jobs. These are machine operators, people who have hands-on ability to install the technology. These are a lot of where the growth is going to be in the jobs.
And the kind of jobs that are more interesting and will keep people there longer.
Yeah, we think. I mean, today's manufacturing facilities are nothing like people remember from years past. They're not dirty places. They're very clean. They're high tech. They're great environments to work in, and there are tremendous jobs there.
When you look at the research on jobs and automation, there are such widely divergent findings. One that I dug up in 2013, a couple of researchers from Oxford found that robotics would be putting 48% of the jobs in the United States in danger. And then last year, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development figured, well, across 21 countries, 9% of jobs would be automated. Why is there such a major difference?
Well, in the case of that Oxford study, I actually debated them. They're looking at tasks and they're saying, here's what the technology can do that people are doing. Therefore, that equals the jobs are going to disappear. That's not at all the case. And some of the other studies have looked at, well, jobs are going to disappear at a slower pace. But the reality is, ask some of these companies how many jobs they would have if they hadn't automated. And the answer is often zero. The reason, because they would have had to send these jobs overseas to China or Mexico or somewhere else, but automation will allow them to compete.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about the challenge of organising the Olympic Summer Games. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 6, using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
In 3 years' time, Tokyo will be recovering from hosting the world's biggest travelling circus, the Summer Olympic Games. 2024 and 2028 have already been awarded to Paris and Los Angeles, respectively, amid waning interest from any other candidate cities. Well, hosting the Olympics, it used to be a hard-fought prize. However, today it seems to be more of a burden for the few cities willing to take them on. Economist Andrew Zimbalist is an expert on the economics of sport, and Jenny Johnson asked him why the Olympics is no longer representative of gold for the host cities.
It's largely about cost. If you look at the recent experience, the cost of hosting Summer Olympics is somewhere between $15 and $20 billion. And the amount of revenue that you bring in from ticket sales and television and sponsorships for the host city is somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 to $5 billion. That's not a very good financial balance. In addition to that, there's a lot of disruption and displacement. In Rio, for example, there were 77,200 residents of the favelas, shanty towns, who were evicted from their homes. In Beijing, the reports are that there were over 1.5 million people who were evicted. This is a regular phenomenon wherever you host the Olympics because you need to clear land. And what also seems to be a perennial phenomenon is that there's environmental disruption and destruction. In Rio de Janeiro, in order to build a golf course that was completely unneeded and is now unused, they had to appropriate land in an environmentally preserved area. It was a wetland, and the ecology of that area was completely destroyed.
What about, though, the argument that an Olympics can lead to greater investment in improving poorer areas? Paris, which has just got 2024, has announced it's going to invest in those poorer outer suburbs of Paris.
It's conceivable that there can be some positive development in those areas. If you break down, however, what happened in East London, you don't find that the low-income residents were benefited by that. London ended up spending over $18 billion in order to host the Games. It seems to me that if you want to help low-income areas, there are much better ways to do that than building a $1.1 billion Olympic stadium and a $400 million velodrome and so on.
So how do you see the future of the Olympics?
I think there are a number of ways to think about that. One of them would be to select a city that basically has all of the infrastructure and all of the venues. One such venue would be Los Angeles. Another way to think about it would be for the IOC to issue a $40 billion bond. The debt service on that might be about $2.5 billion a year. Use the $40 billion to construct a full Olympic apparatus, let's say somewhere between Olympia and Athens in Greece, and use that every 4 years as the venue for the Summer Olympics. And in between, you use those sports facilities as training venues. Those are two ways to think about it, but really at this point in time, those are just pies in the sky, because the IOC is not yet ready to make such radical change.
That's Andrew Symbolist. He's the author of... In 3 years' time, Tokyo will be recovering from hosting the world's biggest traveling circus, the Summer Olympic Games. 2024 and 2028 have already been awarded to Paris and Los Angeles, respectively, amid waning interest from any other candidate cities. Well, hosting the Olympics, it used to be a hard-fought prize. However, today it seems to be more of a burden for the few cities willing to take them on. Economist Andrew Symbolist is an expert on the economics of sport, and Jenny Johnson asked him why the Olympics is no longer representative of goals for the host cities.
It's largely about cost. If you look at the recent experience, the cost of hosting Summer Olympics is somewhere between $15 and $20 billion. And the amount of revenue that you bring in from ticket sales and television and sponsorships for the host city is somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 to $5 billion. That's not a very good financial balance. In addition to that, there's a lot of disruption and displacement. In Rio, for example, there were 77,200 residents of the favelas, shanty towns, who were evicted from their homes. In Beijing, the reports are that there were over 1.5 million people who were evicted. This is a regular phenomenon wherever you host the Olympics because you need to clear land. And what also seems to be a perennial phenomenon is that there's environmental disruption and destruction. In Rio de Janeiro, in order to build a golf course that was completely unneeded and is now unused, they had to appropriate land in an environmentally preserved area. It was a wetland, and the ecology of that area was completely destroyed.
What about, though, the argument that an Olympics can lead to greater investment in improving poorer areas? Paris, which has just got 2024, has announced it's going to invest in those poorer outer suburbs of Paris.
It's conceivable that there can be some positive development in those areas. If you break down, however, what happened in East London, you don't find that the low-income residents were benefited by that. London ended up spending over $18 billion in order to host the Games. It seems to me that if you want to help low-income areas, there are much better ways to do that than building a $1.1 billion Olympic stadium and a $400 million velodrome and so on.
So how do you see the future of the Olympics?
I think there are a number of ways to think about that. One of them would be to select a city that basically has all of the infrastructure and all of the venues. One such venue would be Los Angeles. Another way to think about it would be for the IOC to issue a $40 billion bond. The debt service on that might be about $2.5 billion a year. Use the $40 billion to construct a full Olympic apparatus, let's say somewhere between Olympia and Athens in Greece, and use that every 4 years as the venue for the Summer Olympics. And in between, you use those sports facilities as training venues. Those are two ways to think about it. But really, at this point in time, those are just pies in the sky because the IOC is not yet ready to make such radical change.
That's Andrew Symbolist. He's the author of...
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about a new way for companies to get feedback from their customers. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The view on reviews from some London shoppers. According to one perhaps slightly contentious recent study, online reviews aren't actually very useful. Researchers at the University of Colorado analysed online consumer ratings for more than 1,000 products across 120 categories, everything from sunblock to smoke alarms. They found little correlation between better online user ratings and the products themselves. Product testing showed that the odds of a review accurately reflecting a real product's quality were little better than 50-50. You might as well toss a coin. Reviews, they said, were simply too variant, too subjective, and too few to make them statistically useful. Still, we do depend on them. Eric Ray is the founder of a Utah startup. It's called Podium, and it's one of the fastest-growing firms in a massively fast-growing field. It delivers online reviewing technology for small firms that were previously not online. He began by explaining how his tech worked, giving the example of a small-town dentist.
So you're searching for a place to get some dental work done, and you read a review, you decide to choose a dentist, and then you need to schedule an appointment. That's actually when we come into play. So with our technology, you can actually write from Google, text that business and say, hey, I want to come in for an appointment. So instead of calling and leaving a message or calling when they're not open and playing a huge game of phone tag, you can actually just reach out and message them straight away.
And once I've been to the dentist, how do you then get my feedback?
So because you've been communicating with the dentist already via text messaging or Facebook Messenger, we'll just ask you to leave a review right from that same channel. And so you click a link, takes you right to leave a review. And the thing we do that most other companies don't is we want every person to leave a review. We decided that one of the core principles of Podium would be that we would never do anything for our customer's customer that we wouldn't want done to ourselves personally. Basically, the last thing we want to happen is for Podium to become something that businesses use to spam their customers.
This obviously has gigantic value for companies, right? It's become, I suppose, the norm.
I actually think Amazon has conditioned all of us to make all of our decisions based on reviews. And so over the past few years, people have gotten used to going on Amazon or using Airbnb and using reviews to make purchase decisions. Even if it's a $5 item, you'd still look on Amazon and check out all the reviews before you push purchase. And so
if you don't have reviews, you're in a hard place.
Yeah, and the thing is most of the businesses we work with are not sexy resorts or hip restaurants in San Francisco. A lot of them are car dealers or staffing agencies or solar companies, and you just don't think to leave a review for a business like that after you've had an experience. Unless you had a really negative experience, then usually you remember.
So it's a proper opinion poll, effectively, what you're getting. It's not just a quick, tiny snapshot of the handful of dedicated folks who actually like to review.
The thing that we've been able to do that is most in- surprising for me is we've never had to offer incentives to our customers to leave a review. And then the second thing is we can get upwards of 20% of a business's customer base to review the business.
So you get a 20% review return on all the people going through.
Yeah, we have businesses that have been with us for less than 12 months that have thousands of reviews on Google and Facebook. And so the beautiful thing is, like you said, we're actually generating a more authentic story for these businesses online than if they just have a handful of reviews from people that either like to review businesses or are getting incentivized to do so.
The view on reviews from some London shoppers. According to one perhaps slightly contentious recent study, online reviews aren't actually very useful. Researchers at the University of Colorado analysed online consumer ratings for more than 1,000 products across 120 categories, everything from sunblock to smoke alarms. They found little correlation between better online user ratings and the products themselves. Product testing showed that the odds of a review accurately reflecting a real product's quality were little better than 50-50. You might as well toss a coin. Reviews, they said, were simply too variant, too subjective, and too few to make them statistically useful. Still, we do depend on them. Eric Ray is the founder of a Utah startup. It's called Podium, and it's one of the fastest-growing firms in a massively fast-growing field. It delivers online reviewing technology for small firms that were previously not online. He began by explaining how his tech worked, giving the example of a small-town dentist.
So you're searching for a place to get some dental work done, and you read a review, you decide to choose a dentist, and then you need to schedule an appointment. That's actually when we come into play. So with our technology, you can actually write from Google, text that business and say, hey, I want to come in for an appointment. So instead of calling and leaving a message or calling when they're not open and playing a huge game of phone tag, you can actually just reach out and message them straight away.
And once I've been to the dentist, how do you then get my feedback?
So because you've been communicating with the dentist already via text messaging or Facebook Messenger, we'll just ask you to leave a review right from that same channel. And so you click a link, it takes you right to leave a review. And the thing we do that most other companies don't is we want every person to leave a review. We decided that one of the core principles of Podium would be that we would never do anything for our customer's customer that we wouldn't want done to ourselves personally. Basically, the last thing we want to happen is for Podium to become something that businesses use to spam their customers.
This obviously has gigantic value for companies, right? It's become, I suppose, the norm.
I actually think Amazon has conditioned all of us to make all of our decisions based on reviews. And so over the past few years, people have gotten used to going on Amazon or using Airbnb and using reviews to make purchase decisions. Even if it's a $5 item, you'd still look on Amazon and check out all the reviews before you push purchase. And so
if you don't have reviews, you're in a hard place.
Yeah, and the thing is most of the businesses we work with are not sexy resorts or hip restaurants in San Francisco. A lot of them are car dealers or staffing agencies or solar companies. And you just don't think to leave a review for a business like that after you've had an experience. Unless you had a really negative experience, then usually you remember.
So it's a proper opinion poll, effectively, what you're getting. It's not just a quick, tiny snapshot of the handful of dedicated folks who actually like to review.
The thing that we've been able to do that is most surprising for me is we've never had to offer incentives to our customers to leave a review. And then the second thing is we can get upwards of 20% of a business's customer base to review the business.
So you get a 20% review return on all the people going through.
Yeah, we have businesses that have been with us for less than 12 months that have thousands of reviews on Google and Facebook. And so the beautiful thing is, like you said, we're actually generating a more authentic story for these businesses online than if they just have a handful of reviews from people that either like to review businesses or are getting incentivized to do so.
This is the end of the listening test.